G'day listeners, you are listening to the Natives Rouseabout podcast. I'm your host, Michael, and joining me today, we don't have Matthew Grant because he is unfortunately sick. So instead of our planned Rum Rebellion podcast, we're talking to Kyle and Tom about a mixed bag of topics, including the ANA Charter of Principles, nuclear power, and illiberal democracy. How's it going, Kyle?
Good, thanks, mate. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. And Tom, how about you?
Doing wonderful, mate.
Good to hear. Now, you, dear listeners, might have noticed that the podcast didn't come out last month, and that's because everyone was busy with our national convention for 2024. So this is the big event where all the branches get together, and Tom, how do we feel it went this year?
I thought it went pretty good. I'm not overly familiar with jurisprudence in national law and organisational law, but Mr. Matty Grant, our resident expert, assured us all that utmost care was being taken in ensuring that the continued existence into perpetuity of the organisation was being looked after despite, you know, any lawfare that might pop up from certain types that want to put us down.
Yeah, so, fair enough.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I couldn't make it this year just due to family circumstances, but I heard the speeches were really good. Any particular topics stood out?
Bloody outstanding. One in particular, I do hope we get the speech uploaded purely and in its entirety. It was a wonderful speech. I don't think I should mention the name, but it sounded like something Hughes would have said at the time of the Great War, or maybe a Curtin speech. It was absolutely moving, and I think it'll be a lot more eloquent than what we're about to get into. But yes, there were some wonderful speeches. Yes.
Yeah, and of course, our listeners can always have a taste of that with Sam's coming home speech, which came out instead of the podcast. So with that aside, let's move on to our mixed bag of topics today. And I thought we would start with a bit of poetry, as we want to do on the podcast. So today I thought we might go with a Bruce Dorr poem. Are you guys familiar with him at all?
No, not familiar.
Yeah, no worries. So he's in the 20th century, sort of Roman Catholic poet and obviously Australian. And yeah, he's got some really good stuff, very down-to-earth poetry. Some of it's sort of free verse type stuff, so not so much of that form. But today I thought we might have a bit of a look at one called Enter Without So Much As Knocking. And just at the top of it, there's an epigraph before the poem itself starts. It says, "Remember, man, that thou art dust, and unto dust thou shalt return." And now for the poem. Blink, blink, hospital, silence. 10 days old, carried in the front door in his mother's arms. First thing he heard was Bobby Dazzler on Channel 7. Hello, 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 all you lucky people. And he really was lucky, because it didn't mean a thing to him then. A year or two to settle in and get acquainted with the setup, like every other well-equipped, smoothly run household, his included one economy-sized mum, one Anthony Squire's Coolstream summer weight dad, along with two other kids straight off the junior department rack. When mum won the Lux of Forge tricky tune quiz, she took him shopping in the good as new station wagon, £495 depot at Renault's. Beep, beep, walk, don't walk, turn left, no parking, wait here, no smoking, keep clear, out, off grass, no breathing except by order. Beware of this, watch out for that. My God, beep, the congestion here just gets beep worse every day. Now what the beep, beep does that idiot think he's doing? Beep, beep, and beep. However, what he enjoyed most of all was when they went to the late show at the local drive-in. On a clear night, and he could see beyond the 50-foot screen where giant faces forever snarled, screamed, or make incomprehensible and monstrous love, a pure, unadulterated fringe of sky littered with stars no one had got around to fixing up yet. He'd watched them circling about in luminous groups like kids at the circus who never go quite close enough to the elephant to get kicked. Anyway, pretty soon he was old enough to be realistic like every other godless, money-hungry, backstabbing, miserable so-and-so. And then it was goodbye stars and the soft cry in the corner when no one was looking. Because I'm telling you straight, Jim, it's number one every time for this chicken. Hit wherever you see ahead and kick whoever's down. Well, thanks for a lovely evening, Claire. It's good to get away from it all once in a while. I mean, it's a real battle all the way and a man can't help but feel a little soiled himself at times. You know what I mean? Now take it easy on those curves, Alice, for God's sake. I've had enough for one night with that Claire Jessup. Hey, ease up, will you? Watch it. Probity and Sons Morticians did a really first-class job on his face. Everyone was very pleased. Even adding a healthy tan he'd never had, living, gave him back for keeps the old automatic smile with nothing behind it, winding the whole show up with a nice ride out to the underground metropolis. Permanent residentials, no parking tickets, no taximeters ticking, No Bobby Dazzlers here, no down payments, nobody grieving over halitosis, flat feet, shrinking gums, falling hair. 6 feet down, nobody interested. Blink, blink, cemetery, silence. So that was Enter Without So Much As Knocking by Donald Bruce Dorr. What do you think, fellas?
It's interesting. It's life is short and then it's over.
Yeah. I think the thing with Dorr is he wrote at a time when things were really changing in Australian society, and you've got this sort of post-war development of suburbia and the TVs fully in swing with your Bobby Dazzlers or whatever. Mm. And so he's sort of capturing this move from a more innocent time to full suburbia mode.
Yeah, that was a bit jarring as a poem. I'm not sure if that was meant to evoke what it's like to live in soy-ciety, but yeah, interesting work.
Even though it was written in the 50s, you'd think it was written a lot later with just how he describes the sort of fast pace of it.
Yeah, sort of that cult of speed. I mean, that was talked about all the way at the start of the 20th century by the futurists, if you think about it in the Futurist Manifesto and so on, where they're talking about, we need to elevate speed and everything that's new is good. And if anything's old at all, you know, chuck it in the bin, destroy the museums because we don't give a crap about any of that stuff anymore. So it's kind of really the theme that developed across that whole century, I guess.
I wonder what it would be like adapted to 2024.
Yeah. Well, I think it's only gotten faster when you think about the latest social media and everything's really quick, short attention spans, that sort of thing. So
the reading of the poem would have to have Subway Surfers gameplay playing in the bottom.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been playing the whole time.
All right, yeah. So that's a little bit of standard Aussie culture intro. Anyway, moving on today, we're looking a bit at the ANA, introducing people to some of our key ideas if they've not already come across them. So I thought we would start with probably one of the key documents, which is the Charter of Principles, and sort of just have a chat on each one. So Charter of Principles, the first one is obviously the maintenance and advancement of the welfare of a naturalised European descent national community, that is to say, the advancement and welfare of all Australians. A key word here would be naturalised, right? Because you have a lot of people that come to Australia and then they will form ethnic cliques, right? You think Greeks in Melbourne, they're probably one of the biggest ones, but then you'll also have different sort of Slavic groups and, you know, maybe the Italians as well, right? Some of the quote-unquote new Australians of the post-war migrations, and they'll sort of think about Australia, unfortunately, like a lot of other ethnics as an economic zone, right, for wealth extraction, but they'll still identify with, quote unquote, the home country, be it, you know, Italy or Greece or Russia or wherever that may be, right? So I think a key point is that we're after the advancement and the welfare of naturalized European descent national community, because otherwise it's still like a force that's tearing us apart rather than creating that sense of national unity that we're going to need if we're going to survive on this continent the way things are going. What do you reckon, Kyle?
Yeah, most definitely. We have developed a unique Australian culture. There's no doubt about it. And that comes from hard work on this hard land. And there's no doubt that it was cultivated by Europeans, and Europeans still uphold this nation to this day. And I definitely agree. There's small enclaves of foreigners that exist that refuse to assimilate and only hang out with their own types. It's not a thing that we should embrace. Multiculturalism is a failed ideology.
Yeah, spot on. I think the other side of it too, to be fair, is that Europeans are closely related enough that they can be naturalized. So for these people that are here that maybe have grown up alienated from our heritage, our classical Australian culture, the bush culture, the bush poetry, and all of that stuff, right? It's possible to find your home here and to find your identity and to connect with that, even if you are coming from people who've migrated here later on, right? So it might not be as natural to you as your classic Anglo-Celtic Aussie, but even back in you know, the Eureka Stockade, the Eureka days, it's being written up by an Italian, right? So it's, yeah, we're close enough that if people naturalize and will intermingle, it's not going to sort of damage the foundational stock of this country. So I think there's a real balance in the first principle in the Charter of Principles between staying true to our heritage and making sure that we're not losing what makes us Australian, but also, you know, having a bit more of a pan-European outlook rather than like a purely Anglophile perspective on Australia as well. Well, if you're happy, guys, we can move on to the second one.
Yeah, sure. I don't really have much to add. Yeah.
Yeah, no worries. So the second of our key principles, the development, commerce and industry in Australia, which advance the welfare, security and dignity of Australians. So, Tom, how are we going about doing this?
Well, at the moment, the ANA's coffers aren't quite large enough to rival the international financiers that we find ourselves up against, those financiers that all just happen to be from London, New York, and that one other city in that one country in the Middle East. But at the moment, we are primarily focused on our goals as a fraternity and helping our communities on a individual level. You know, it's not hard to set an example and show a community that has been deracinated and stripped of its culture, not so much in some areas, but certainly in the urban centres in each state, we're all told to be very concrete, very grey, very economic unit. And even while we are working on amassing the financial force that is required to start onshoring businesses and industry again without help from our very globalist government, we are focusing on, you know, just helping little old ladies across the street and making sure every brother of ours, every Australian bloke, you know, is getting employed. If they're down on their luck, if they're going through hard times, it is about fraternity first. That is the goal of our fraternity, to be a fraternal organisation. And even while we are still at our humble beginnings, attempting to rebuild the ANA to the heights it achieved in the 1900s, I think we're making good progress. I've certainly seen a lot of blokes have their lives really turned around and influenced for the better by just little actions of blokes who want to rebuild their country man by man, step by step, little picture first.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we might not be able to advance the welfare, security and dignity of all Australians at the moment, but we are helping those Australians who are forming the nucleus of the new community, the new reinvigorated Australia that's going to take us forward, that's going to have to ride out the storm of globalism and mass immigration and all these other things that are going to be the challenges for us and probably for future generations even in this country if we don't totally win total Australian victory.
We will be achieving total Australian victory. Let's not condemn our sons just yet. I think they'll be just fine. As long as we put in the hard yakka, I reckon next generation, Holden factories will be reopened. With fingers crossed, we'll get there, boys.
Inshallah.
We'll there. Inshallah, yeah. The Holden and Ford rivalry will return.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll get in the barriers.
Anything
back
to add, Kyle? Or
it starts with our membership, and our membership is full of all the right people. Like, we've got really intelligent, really skilled guys amongst our small group, and there's no one that you can't rely on in the ANA. You can go to anyone for anything, really. And the beauty of it is we're looking to create businesses, to employ our own, to help our own. And I think in the next few years, we're really going to see that grow, and that's the main thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we're all about longevity in our association. As Grant always says, we don't want to be another flash in the pan organization that comes and burns brightly but burns out very quickly. So I think that's a very good point. All right, let's move on to number three of six. So number three is recognition and encouragement of high ideals of national life and character and the stimulation of Australian literature, arts, science, conservation and industry. I think a key point there would be the idea of the stimulation of Australian literature and arts. And we do try and to do that, don't we, guys? I think a good example would be the recent sort of revival or imagination, I guess, of Banjo Paterson Day, where we're taking to having that as sort of our national day for celebrating poetry. And we always like to bring a little bit of poetry onto the show, as we did earlier. But we want to carry our heritage forward for the next generation. And like I said before on one of the other principles, a lot of people are alienated from Australian heritage, from what it means to be Australian, especially if you grew up in the suburbs, you know, you go to your public school or whatever. Like, there's an underlying current of Australianness and a sort of larrikin spirit and all that. but you might not necessarily be exposed to or connect with the greater aspects of our past and the great literature and music and all these things. So for me, that would be a key point there, recognition of the high ideals. How about you guys?
Yeah, I definitely enjoy the works of Banjo and Henry Lawson as well. I've seen a lot of this country. I've been from one side to the other and through the middle. And I've got to say, I was over the Lachlan River once, and Clancy of the Overflow was on my mind, and I shed a small tear. I fucking love that poem. yeah, it just, everything is about bush poetry, beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, and I was quite struck recently on a trip through Sydney that I made that really made it click just how unique Australian culture can be from the literal built foundations of the environment we find ourselves in. Walking through Sydney, central Sydney, and seeing the old Commonwealth Bank buildings sort of juxtaposed with all of these grey husk, you know, these concrete and glass hives against the silhouette of our old Commonwealth Bank building, the old jail, the old, you know, that first settlement that was built under the Sydney Bridge, or by the Sydney Bridge. I'm getting my geography confused. But, yeah, seeing the sorts of buildings that we used to have and thinking about how that compares to the sorts of buildings we have in each of our cities and towns, it really, we built our architecture, obviously inspired quite a lot by European standards and European styles, but we took Australian stones and Australian materials and the environmental conditions that were imposed upon us and really built something of our own. The workers' huts that we developed in the suburbs of Melbourne, the stilt houses of the more northern and tropical states, you know, the beautiful sandstone and I believe limestone architecture of particularly the churches in across South Australia and New South Wales. We really do have such a rich tradition of building that is not like, you know, all these grand old castles and shit you see from Europe that so few people appreciate just because we spend a lot of our working lives in, you know, offices with air conditioning and floor to ceiling pane windows that you don't really want to appreciate because you look outside and it's just looking at litter and shit all over the floor. So bringing that culture, bringing an appreciation of our surroundings back and bringing back an environment that my kids can love and can view as their own quintessentially Australian architecture and environment. That's a very big factor for me of why I want to join the ANA. I have that vision. I want my kids to grow up around a landscape that looks like ours and looks like home.
Yeah, I think another good point is in here is that we're looking for high ideals of character as well. And that's not to necessarily throw rocks at other groups or anything like that, but it just happens to be a thing, a fact, I guess, of fringe politics. You could say that it can attract these sort of like fringe characters that are, you know, they don't really fit in society, and then maybe not coming to Australian nationalism out of a sincere love or out of principle, but perhaps as a sort of way to sort of spit on society, essentially. So yeah, we definitely want to make sure that all the people coming in are of good character and are sort of on the right trajectory, because it's also about taking people from where they're at, assuming they're not, you know, totally falling apart, and showing them a better way.
Building the man, as Matty Grant would say if he were on the podcast. It's all about building the man.
All right, next one, number four. So the advancement and defence of lives well lived for members in which employment, family, good health, hobbies, friends, community, citizenship, study, politics and religion are all embraced and integrated into a cohesive, balanced and meaningful living existence. And I think that sort of kind of flows on quite well from what we just said. It's about living the right kind of life, and that will, I think that will affect sort of the people around you. So I know with me, a lot of my, I guess, associates and my mates have found the association to be something that they would be interested in as well. And I think it's just a matter of the kind of people that I've tended to surround myself with. So if you surround yourself with good people and you're living a good, balanced life, I think that's sort of very attractive to other people, and that's something that people are going to want to have and want to enjoy as well. What do you guys think in terms of how the association fits into your lives?
Like politics is always talked about amongst whatever group you. I suppose I spend most of my time at work, and so obviously it comes up here and there. And most white tradesmen share the exact same beliefs, and when I discuss the ANA and I discuss the principles, they're all in agreement. It's amazing. Like, some might not be the right fit for the organization, but most guys are pretty much of the same mind because they can tell what's right. They're born here. They worked hard. They know what the country needs.
Yeah, right. Growth.
Yeah. I do think that the organization has seen surrounding, I think more than just focusing on recruiting blokes of good character and, you know, attempting to all egg each other on to better ourselves so that we can be examples for our community and better them. The organization has really helped me put my mates outside of the ANA into a mindset of, you know, how can I help uplift these guys? How can I, you know, the mindset of all of us wanting to uplift each other and ensure that we maintain a state of good character and we have no vice, set good examples for our kids so that they can set good examples for their kids. That mindset, it's since joining, it has really stuck with me a lot more, and I've carried it a lot more in principle. And I find myself, rather than just thinking about whether or not I want to do something, I think about, you know, when I'm out with my mates and we might have done something a bit too irresponsible, you know, a bit of hooning, a bit of tasteful hooning or something like that. I think to myself, you know, do I want my son doing this one day, being a Yes. dickhead the way I'm being a dickhead right now? And it hasn't always stopped me, you know, sometimes you just got to downshift and rev it a little bit, but you know, you've got to within the speed limit, just for the noise. We would never do that. But, you know, sometimes sometimes you don't think about that. You find yourself having lapses in judgment, but being part of the organization really has made me see forward a lot more. And I find that inspiring. And I find myself basically by accident inspiring some of the blokes around me who are not part of the organization yet, but fingers crossed, you know, these tradies, you get them off the beers, we'll make proper civilized patriots out of them one day yet.
Yeah, righto. Yeah. And I think it's important to think about as well some of the other aspects there, like, you know, hobbies and good health, so your hikes and all that sort of thing. It's something that you can do not just on your own in an atomized way, but you really should be doing it in the context of a community of your people and contributing to something greater. And I think that's part of what it means there when it says integrated, right? Integrated into a cohesive, meaningful existence. You've got to be integrated into a greater context than just yourself. And so many aspects of modern society are designed to atomize you, right? That's the whole kind of principle of liberalism, is the idea of atomizing everyone and taking them out of their context, you know, abstracting each person into just this sort of featureless individual, right? That's you know, can be switched out with anyone else, right? So you can switch out Tom with you know, Prandeep from India, because they're both individuals, right? But we to push back against that, you've got to really contextualize yourself and make yourself an integrated personality. Yeah, I mean, even the suburbia stuff that we talked about with that, or we sort of briefly mentioned with that Bruce Dorr poem, right? I mean, all that sort of stuff has had an atomizing effect towards the nuclear family first, and then, you know, we've seen the nuclear family collapse into, you know, your whole phenomenon of single mums and dads that don't know what they're doing and only see the kids on the weekend or whatever. So, yeah, we really want to be sort of reconstituting society on our level, on our local communal level. And then, you know, as the branches continue to spawn, to pop up across Australia, we are going to have our nation unified again. Anyway, that's my take on it. All right, if there's nothing more with that, let's go to number 5, which I think is a really important one and a key distinctive of our organization. And that's the advancement of and defense of the constitutional model of our organization, in which leadership is accountable, finances are transparent, bona fide members have basic rights to appeal and mediation, and in which the association's ends are for honorable and charitable purposes. Tom, do you want to start us off this time?
Yes. Well, we learned from our past in the ANA. It was founded, or the modern rendition was founded by Matty Grant as an attempt to rectify a lot of the troubles that were occurring in other parts of the nationalist sphere in Australia. There was a lot of concern about fraud. There was a lot of concern about where money was going and where that money would go should legal hot water arise. And I have to say the constitutional model that we have had implemented and the separated bank accounts that come with it, there's, you know, we get a formal bank account that is belonging to the organization. It is fully transparent. It's not any one person's. You can't just nick shit out of the account and not be held accountable. It is a very clear paper trail that can be, you know, vetted and checked by any member at any time. And I think that that keeps that, not only does that keep everyone honest, but I think everyone in the ANA has only been an honest bloke because it's that principle, that model that we have has just kept out bad actors. We have not had a single money problem. And if I can chalk that up to any one thing, I reckon it would be that legally on the question of money, it's bulletproof. Everything is for the members. Everything is crystal clear. There's no mud yet.
Yeah. And I think a really good example of how it can go wrong if you don't have all those things in a row all set up properly is the I don't know, are you guys familiar with the story of the National Justice Party in the US?
No.
I've heard many stories, but I think I know the one you're referring to in particular. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was basically set up. I mean, it was called a party, but I think it wasn't set up as a party anyway. Members had, I believe, absolutely no rights. The model was, you know, pay up to the e-celebs, and the e-celebs will sort it out at the top, and we're going to recreate 1930s Germany in the US. Just trust us with your money, bro.
Hasn't happened yet.
You know, then it turns out, you know, one of the guys is running around on holidays off their money, and then there's all sorts of rumors. There's no rights. There's no proper structure. So as soon as the night of the long knives happens, the leadership purges. It's all over. There was no way for them to actually call people to account and ensure that the organization was suitably accountable and transparent. And obviously that's the sort of thing that can burn out a lot of people, especially in a situation where you've got that sort of culture of, you know, we're the only game in town and you really should be with us. Everyone else is just a loser, just an idiot. Give us your money. We're building something real. But if you don't have the proper foundations, if you're building on sand, it can all go wrong very quickly. Yeah, it was really a shit show. If people haven't heard of it, they should look it up, because it's definitely basically an example of what we're trying to avoid by having this principle in our charter, which is that everything has to be absolutely on point, legally sound, and that we always vote in our members, vote in our representatives onto the committee, and we can call them to account if need be. Anything to add there, Kyle?
Yeah, there are no Greek thieves around here, that's for sure.
No Cypriot dark manlets.
No, zero. I remember when I first met Mr. Grant in circa 2018, that was one of his main sort of selling points. Like, it just gives you a lot of faith, a lot of confidence in an organisation. You don't feel like you're giving something away for nothing.
Yeah, I think that's very important as well. It helps members, you know, feel comfortable investing their time, their money, their energy into something that they know isn't going to just disappear overnight because, you know, of a personality clash or some, you know, stupid misunderstanding or perhaps paranoia on the part of the Führer that somebody's coming for his position and is going to be the next philosopher king of Australian nationalism who lays down the law.
Yes. Having come from the sort of the offshoots of the Club Nation days myself, like, I'm well aware of how it can all go downhill pretty quickly. So, yeah.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, and last one, excuse me, the promotion of traditional Australian culture, in which all men are treated frankly with basic dignity, where men are accountable for the leadership, care and welfare of their wives, children and families, where men live lives free from vice, leaving behind them a legacy of honour. I believe this principle is actually the one that got us called an anti-woman hate group by one of these organisations that exist to suck up government money in a scam. Yeah, apparently where men are accountable for the leadership and welfare of their wives, that's not kosher, that's not good.
No, not good at all. A woman is probably my favourite person in the world, so I definitely hate women.
Frankly, you know, I love the ladies. I am absolutely a male feminist. You know, I'm a sensitive young man. I just want to absolve these poor girls of the burden of the responsibility of making decisions, you know, and worrying about all these crazy things like taxes and foreign policy and Israel wars. You know, that should be our job. You know, these poor girls, they don't deserve all this stress. And as I've said, giving up vices, I'm off the hooning. I promised the missus, I'm off the hooning. I swore.
From a more serious perspective, though, I think most guys' number one goal is to be a family man, like, is to be that provider. Like, I know that's definitely my sort of number one goal in life.
Yeah, and it is about having children and family, because that's the whole basis of the nation. Without successful families, you don't have the broader kinship community that nationalism seeks to defend. So, again, it's like we've sort of discussed this whole point throughout, but you've got to start at the very basic level and make sure everything is integrated and working properly at the very sort of foundation. Otherwise, very difficult to build something that's going to work. Or say if you're looking to set up a community outside of the city, which we could very well be doing in the not too distant future, but you're not going to build it on neats. Right, who can't do anything, who haven't got a family, who haven't got children. You have to have people that are actually capable, free from vice, and worthy of the basic dignity with which they're treated. So I think a man, if he has any self-respect, is going to expect that. And so that's kind of the traditional Australian culture of mateship is built on that. You know, we might poke fun at each other and, you know, tear each other down a bit for a laugh or whatever, but underlying it all, you know, it never really undermines that basic dignity that people are treated with and that we expect in the association. All right, guys, any more comments on this principle or the whole Charter of Principles? Because that is the six principles, which are basically the core foundation of the ANA. If you didn't know what we're about, hopefully you know what we're about now, or at least you know a little bit more.
No, all good for me.
No, I think that's it. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Next stop on the podcast express, I guess, is going to be a little review of an article by Mr. John Lawson of the National Observer. So I might give it a read through first, and then we can discuss. So we are looking at anti-liberal democracy on the National Observer. So it says, out of disgust toward the condition of the modern West, many instinctively turn to systems of government stripped of the decrepit and dishonest qualities which characterize liberal democracy in search of alternative solutions. Members of both the left and right have in recent years grown comfortable forwarding radically alternate systems of leadership, selection and government, authoritarian and libertarian alike. However, I believe for the most part they are missing the mark. Generally, the most alluring aspect of these alternative solutions, the streamlined, action-oriented elements they provide, often at the expense of reduced guardrails that might protect against tyrannical abuses of power and corruption. Some of our country's greatest men were quasi-dictators, Governor Macquarie, Governor Arthur Phillip, and J.B.L.K. Peterson, just to name a few. When these selflessly motivated men come to power, society flourishes as they are capable of wielding the full power of the state to swiftly correct societal ills and redirect resources towards rapid technological, moral, and legal advancement. Governor Arthur Phillip successfully planted the seed of civilization on the Australian continent. Governor Macquarie re-established order after the corruption of his rum-trading predecessor left the colony of New South Wales in disarray, and JBL oversaw the transformational development of Queensland. On the other hand, however, as we are so often warned by popular news media, when tyrannical and selfish men claw their way to the top position, little stands in the way of their abusive will. Examples include Governor-General John Kerr, who used his station to carry out his petty personal revenge, Governor MacArthur, the corrupt rum-trading predecessor of Governor Macquarie, and Joe Bielke for being Joe Bielke. Taking all this into account, I believe that an answer is to be found in Australia's own history that combines the advantages of democracy, peaceful transitions of power, stability and oversight, with the benefits of authoritarianism, speed, directness, and the ability to pursue a grander vision. This is the system of government that carried six colonies at the end of the world to become the Australian nation in 1901. And it even still lingered to some degree throughout our rapid ascent from nationhood to a position as one of the world leaders in the realms of quality of life, industry, technological advancement, and military capability. That system can be best labelled as illiberal democracy. I'll just do the next section and then maybe we can discuss before we finish the whole thing. So illiberal democracy, as Lawson defines it, is in opposition to liberal democracy, a representative system of government in which ministers are selected by a vote, limited to only certain subsets of the population with strict limits on the forces allowed to influence the government formed. A government that resembles this definition could be said to have existed from the 1840s, when only wealthy white male landowners had the right to vote, through to the 1850s, during which all white men gained the right, through to 1902, when white women followed suit, all the way to its conclusion in the 1940s, when all race-based restrictions were finally lifted. So what do we think about this so far? I mean, just my first sort of impression is that it's actually very similar to what we've already been talking about with the Charter of Principles and the implementation of sort of, I guess, democratic elements in terms of rights for members and the ability to vote for our committees. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, you know, I think having an illiberal democracy really does draw back to that point of treating every man with a degree of basic decency and respect, because I think it is disrespectful to someone who is just a bit of a fuck about to let them be, you know, let them wallow in a lack of responsibilities and a lack of life and duty and doing anything for themselves. I think illiberal democracy is definitely the only path that a democracy can take and be sustainable in the long term, because a society built from its constituents can only be built from responsible constituents. You know, historical democracies, things like the Athenian democracy, or for the more Germanic, you know, the folk moots, I believe it's pronounced. Yeah, these were the not things. Yeah, the things, they weren't listening to some fucking eunuch slave off in the corner that just like got bread, and you know, they were listening to it could be militaristic. You know, you can have a militaristic democracy, you have to have national service, Starship Troopers bullshit, whatever. But at the times, it wasn't just the military, it was responsible men. You know, you had to be a citizen. You had to be a citizen for Athens. That meant more than just birth. You had to be of demonstrated birth and of good birth. You had to demonstrate that you were a good man and a good Athenian. And I think that having liberal democracy is just a pretext to have this, you know, this economic zone instead of a nation. If anyone can vote, the local businessman, pillar of the community, upholds like half the community, his family man. If that guy has as much authority over the direction of his nation and the future of his nation as a crackhead with no money that lives on the street, but both of them have enough valid ID to vote, or enough that both of them are allowed to vote, then the system is functionally doomed. There's no reason to be responsible. There's no reason to vote for interests that will be stable in the long term. You would only ever be incentivized to vote for Gibbs right now before everything goes to shit.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And I think another criterion should be to bring in a bit of Plato, because Plato, he sort of, in his final book, The Laws, he did, like, he's known for The Republic and The Philosopher King that I mentioned before, but in his final book, he advocated more of a mixed regime that included democratic elements, but with, like, epistocratic or you could say technocratic oversight from people that are actually educated and experts and that sort of thing. And maybe that's going to sound kind of like the wrong way after COOF, when we had the message of trust the experts and all this stuff that was more part of the oligarchic media show, we could say. But if we're talking about real people who kind of are oriented towards, you know, what is actually good, what is actually making people healthy in the body, sound of mind, there's actually nothing wrong with having sort of educational requirements, we could say, to have voting. Like, you can't just be, you know, some bloke can vote and he has no idea what he's even voting for, or he has no clue what his vote is even going to carry out. Like, he's going to be like, what's a referendum? He's got no idea how the government works. I mean, I just think that people like that probably shouldn't be voting, and the system should be set up that way. And also that another way it could be restricted is that you have to actually be part of a family, so that you've got some skin in the game, and you're not just going to be like a boomer who's going to extract wealth and then, you know, waste it on cruising or whatever. Anyway, Kyle, what do you reckon?
Well, I really like what Tom said about it towards the end there. But when I read through the article and I see names like Macquarie and Arthur Phillip, the sort of things that come to mind is power. And at the moment, if you look at politics in general, you look at, like, the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, you don't see power. Like, you see weakness, if anything. You look at the Senate and you see fucking Hot Wheels in there and you think weakness. Like, if you limit voting, yeah, it kind of sounds bad, but people who actually have sway in the system and actually whose vote will, like, make an impact, if you limit the voting to only those people, you would elect someone, as the article quite says, who comes and, like, revitalizes society. Tom put it perfectly. The businessman and the crackhead have the same amount of power in the current system. It will be doomed to fail.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you sort of raised a good point on the quality of politician. That's kind of the next bit that Lawson goes into. So I might just finish off a little bit that's left of the article, and then we can do some maybe closing thoughts on it. But to continue on, so Lawson says, the truly Australian solution to our present decline is to reimpose elements of the anti-liberal democracy that weighed more heavily the opinion of our society's wisest and most experienced. What would this look like in the modern day? Ideally, it would mean a compulsory requirement that for someone to be eligible to stand as a politician, he must be a Christian, father of good character, descendant of founding stock Australians. More realistically, rolling back the liberal element of liberal democracy would mean aggressive electoral reform that favours the most conservative elements in society. One way to do this would be to break up some of the largest regional electorates into smaller seats, which, owing to the stunted growth of leftism in areas outside of the major cities, would in all practicality result in more conservative Christian founding stock Australians sitting in parliament. Similarly, some sort of scheme that awards additional votes to soldiers and ex-servicemen would be another way to give heavier weight to a cohort of Australians who are disproportionately patriotic or possess nationalist instincts. There are many similar solutions, voluntary voting, for example, which with enough political will would go a long way to securing a better future for Australia. However, the details are not especially important at present. The other half of restoring an illiberal democracy would be entirely freeing our country of all foreign and hostile interests. This would require an aggressive McCarthyist treatment of foreign operatives, no matter whether they are agents of foes or supposed allies. Further, the power of all lobbies, especially those corrosive to the fabric of Australian life, must be sharply curtailed, and the political donation process must be made transparent as glass. The political impracticality of these ideas is not lost on me. I have absolutely no expectation of them being implemented by the current generation of politicians. However, in a hypothetical future where an Australia First leader rose to power and wanted to safeguard the country from sinking back to its current state, the program I have outlined above would be a good starting point. So that was John Lawson's anti-liberal democracy on his publication, the National Observer. It's a great publication. It puts out stuff by our guys. He does an interesting podcast that you can listen to when you're not listening to this one. And he's talked to Matty Grant and a whole bunch of other interesting people from Australian nationalism. So worth giving it a listen. Anyway, guys, what did we think of the second half? I think we sort of anticipated a few things. The Starship Troopers call out, as Tom mentioned, additional votes to soldiers and ex-servicemen. Always mandatory, I suppose, especially when you got to roll up to squish the bugs. And I believe the Heinlein's original concept of the bugs in Starship Troopers is actually meant to be based on like the communist Chinese. So if you're familiar with that book, and you probably, a lot of guys have probably seen the movie, there's actually kind of a underlying racial element to it, although Heinlein himself was more a libertarian type. He read some of his other stuff. But anyway, I'm sort of going on tangent at the moment. Tom, you want to bring us back on a line?
Yeah, I think bringing up the point of splitting electorates was right on the money. This might be a hot take. You know, this might be a bit of a controversial opinion. It is an opinion that might only be held by myself, but I think even in a scenario where we do have, repaired demographics in terms of, you know, the makeup of the country, I think securing democracy or a stable democratic-like form of government, the big key to that would be the states themselves being split up to what they realistically should be. I think, you know, as crazy as it sounds, the big example is Far North Queensland, but I think within each state, there's examples of entire regions, millions, maybe not millions, but, you know, in some parts close to a million or millions of people who New South Wales, Wollongong and Newcastle, New England and Illawarra regions, they look at Sydney and they look at that absolute blight and it's spread westward. Even if Sydney was full of Australians, do these farming communities, to these, iron processing communities want the same governance, the same policies, industrial policies, environmental policies as, you know, heavily industrialized urban financial centers? I think we need to go back to something that was being cried for very early in the life of this nation, which is heavy federalism, like real federalism, with regions being a lot more independent and people being allowed to, you know, regions being allowed to govern themselves in the interests of their own communities.
Yeah, very good. Kyle, do you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I think you only need to look at an electoral map to see that, like, if you split WA up into 10 different electorates, you would have 10 extra conservative seats. It's pretty, we've kind of predicted how that article would end. And I agree with it. I agree with the additional votes for soldiers and ex-servicemen. I'd also put out additional votes for business owners. Business owners should have sway in government. Their vote matters because often the government decides who they can and can't hire, which is obviously something we're all well aware of due to the persecution we face.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Okay, so that was that. Stop on the Podcast Express. How are we feeling, boys? Are we about ready to get off the train, or do you want to keep going a little bit?
Are we doing nuclear? I feel like I'm just rambling again.
That's all right. This is the Ramble Podcast.
Yeah.
Last minute due to Grant's sickness, so...
Yeah, I'm sure
there are still a handful of listeners that have kept on for an hour in. All right. Should we do a nuclear? Do you want to just talk about it, or we could read the article? It's pretty long, though. I reckon we just talk about it.
Yeah, it's been covered pretty heavily in mainstream. So
yeah, so where do we stand on the question? I mean, I am pretty for it. I think it would be good for our autarky. It's something that we have a lot of that resource, and it's going to provide like a stable base load that we can, you know, I think some of the criticisms have been like, oh, we're going to have like too much power if we do that, and it's going to impact, you know, people's home solar or whatever. But I think we need to have a bit more of a futuristic vision in this country of building something rather than just being an extraction zone for other places, which has unfortunately been, I guess, one of the big problems across our history, is that we're always being seen as, you know, either we're sending stuff off to the UK with its factories, or we're just fully owned by the US and the US stock market. So yeah, I think we actually need a bit of vision in this country, and maybe this is like the only bit of vision that we're getting out of Canberra at the moment. But what do you guys think? Do you agree, Kyle? Or?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I actually always have been on the nuke. I've always considered it to be a good idea. Funnily enough, about a week before the announcement of the proposed sites, I was only thinking about a specific town. I thought that'd be a great spot for a nuclear power plant. And then lo and behold, Dutton announces that town. But like, working in the resources industry, we have a huge amount of uranium. And then the argument would also be that we have a huge amount of lithium as well. Often I've seen it, the argument for anti-nuclear power is the devastation it's going to cause mining uranium. I'm not sure if anyone's considered that if we go to clean energy or renewables, that we still need to store the power, and therefore we still need lithium. And I can tell you that lithium mining is exactly the same as uranium mining. You still got to blow up the ground. You still got to dig holes. It's all the same.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Interesting perspective that you can add. Tom, what do you reckon?
Well, I think the debate of whether we go uranium or whether we stick to natural gas might have a lot more, you know, that's a lot more nuanced. But I think the question of whether we want all these gay fucking fans in the sky and giant fields of cadmium-filled flat glass where sheep and wedge-tailed eagles once roamed, you know, I think that question is far more simply answered by asking supporters if they'd want to work in the industry. You know, 9 times out of 10, you ask someone who is working class and has a fucking heart attack every time they see their power bill if they'd be willing to dig up, you know, work in the mines, or if they'd be willing to, through 15 layers of protective clothing, handle mildly radioactive waste, which is mostly gloves and, you know, decommissioned safety gear. That's what most nuclear waste is. The fuel gets burnt in the reactor completely. We no longer have, it's not fallacy. What do they call it? It's bullshit when people talk about, oh, a lot of it is uranium isotopes that we can't use. The reactors we have these days burn hot enough to burn through all uranium isotopes, doesn't poison the reactor, doesn't create waste. And so a lot of people who you ask if they want nuclear power, they would be willing to work in nuclear waste management. I would be willing to work with the nuclear industry. But if you go to Greens voters and all these fucking 1 centimeter diameter wrist Melburnians, and ask if they would be willing to swap places with the Vietnamese child slaves that like decommission the fiberglass and pull fiberglass and resin apart from old wind turbines, or you ask if they'd be willing to swap places with third worlders who have lung problems and die by 35 because they all get cadmium poisoning from solar panel decommissioning. No greenie poof wants to be in that position. It is entirely, if we succeed, if Australia was an autarky, or even if it was just a reasonable economy that kept a lot of its own industry, even if we were still under liberalism, the renewables industry is fundamentally a sham. You can only have renewables if you've got, you know, massive open cut lithium mines and child slaves somewhere to do the work that no human being should really be forced to do. Whereas nuclear is good jobs for good Australians and good low power bills for our pensioners who are fucking struggling at the moment. It really is a question that is as simple as that. So I think the answer is as simple as that.
Yeah, with the pensioners, you're right. I know I've heard just through extended networks and stuff that, you know, a lot of old people these days are choosing between, you know, am I going to keep the heater on for winter or am I going to eat this week? So, you know, the state of things in this country is going downhill pretty rapidly, which is only making it more important for people to get organized and to start building, like we talked about, start integrating your life, as we talked about with the Charter of Principles. And you know, John Lawson was a bit negative about his illiberal democracy coming about you know, today, but it's kind of already being done in the association, I think, on a small scale, and that's kind of where it's going to start. So, yeah, blast from the past, going back to the other topics. But, yeah, I mean, in terms of nuclear, we're already getting nuclear submarines as the other point. So, I mean, we're going to have a nuclear industry in Australia that's capable of maintaining these if we're going to have any real semblance of autonomy when it comes to something, you know, as basic to our sovereignty and our national interest as our defence forces. So, I mean, I think currently they're kind of looking at, oh, maybe we can just get like the Yanks to run it all. But obviously, I mean, yeah, it's kind of a bit too much mask off, perhaps, on how little on the vassal question. Yeah,
we will be free one day.
Mm.
One day, shake off the reins, shake off the tendrils of the American dogs,
shake off the stink.
We love our Yanks. We love the ones that help out and throw a bit of money. Throw a bit of money at Australian nationalism. You can donate. You can donate on the website. Okay.
Yeah, we love the ones outside that part, outside of DC. Those ones are outside Washington.
Yeah. All right, boys. I think I'm going to wrap it up. We've gone for about an hour. So to the listeners. Indeed. Let us know in the comments what topics you'd like to hear about from us, or if there's a particular topic relating to Australia, the ANA, that you would like us to do a show on. As always, I'd encourage all our supporters in the audience to make sure you like and subscribe and share our content far and wide. I would love to share our show with as many good Aussies as possible. Lastly, if you want to reach out, you can find us at oznatives.com. Signing off, that's Michael.